Yeah. So I wanted to just make a couple of comments to tie up a few of the loose ends of what I said, and then I'm going to start in a somewhat different direction. You know, Shoghi Effendi has said that there are two kinds of Baha'is. He said there are those whose religion is Baha'i and those who live for the faith. And he said, of course, if we can be the second kind, it is much more meritorious in the sight of God. Now, I say this in respect to the implicit question of why it is that so many Baha'is, so many of us, do not or have not conceived of the faith as this pursuit of this authentic relationship with God, the relentless pursuit of this authentic relationship with God. Remember, again, the quote that we read again this morning where Shoghi Effendi says, we should become entirely selfless and devoted to God so that every day and at every moment we seek to do only what God would have us do and in the way He would have us do it. Well, the simple fact is this. If we relentlessly pursue the will of God, then we will find the will of God. But maybe the will of God is not what we want, you know. So in other words, Baha'u'llah has given us this promise that that God will never allow any sincere seeker to go astray, right? That God in His justice and His love and His mercy will not allow that anyone who sincerely seeks will be kept back from finding the truth. Because again, God is all powerful. He could do this. I mean, if God wanted to veil the truth from us in such a way that we could never find it no matter how hard we seek, He could certainly do that. He could certainly do that. And sometimes people become discouraged and they think, well, God has, of course, slightly veiled the truth from us. I mean, He has required that we do have to make this effort that we talked about, and we do have to seek. We do have to be active in our response. We don't have immediate access to it. He has given us immediate access to material reality. We don't have to go to school in order to see the sun and the earth and so on. So He's given us immediate access to the least important dimension of reality. He's given us immediate access to material reality. He has not given us immediate access to spiritual reality. Or I should say, that's not really true. But He has not given us immediate access to an understanding of spiritual reality. In other words, we can understand certain things about material reality just by common sense observation without any significant effort. But we can't understand spiritual reality in this way. We have to make a more deliberate effort to understand spiritual reality. So it is slightly veiled from us. So sometimes, of course, when we're in the depths of despair or suffering, things are very difficult. It seems to us that spiritual reality is very veiled. And sometimes we have this sense of how thick the veil is and how hard it is to find it. But at other times, of course, we feel very close to God and it seems very easy and very obvious. Overall, in other words, the most objective thing we can say is that God has deliberately veiled spiritual reality to some extent, to an extent that means that we have to seek for it, that we have to have an active response, because what He wants is our active participation in this relationship. In other words, we are created, as I said this morning, to be partners in dialogue with God. Not just passive recipients of God's grace, and not just automatons, but we are created to be active partners in dialogue with God. This is, of course, a dialogue that is initiated by God. It is God who determines the parameters of it. So it's not a dialogue that we initiate. We don't initiate the dialogue. But it can't become a dialogue until we respond adequately. So spiritual growth, if you want to say, spiritual development, moral development, just means learning how to respond appropriately to God's initiative. I mean, this is another way of defining spiritual development. It is just learning how. We are not born with the knowledge. We don't have the spontaneous knowledge of how to respond adequately to God. We have to learn how. And that's what spiritual development is. It's just learning how to respond adequately. But the point is that God will help us do this. In other words, He wants this. He desires this. And so He has not made it difficult just to torment us. He's made it just difficult enough that we actually have to make an effort. But once we make the effort, then He smooths the path for us, and he opens the way, and he makes it accessible. But what this means is, and this is what I'm going to talk about primarily for the rest of the session, what this means, though, is that we have to give up the illusion of control of our lives. Now, I say the illusion of control because, in fact, we have no control whatsoever over our lives. But in the materialistic civilization that we have generated the illusion of control. We have generated the illusion of possession. We have generated the illusion of possession. You see, we can possess nothing. So, to see this, let's ask the following question. This is an exercise I do. This is a pedagogical exercise I do when I give these lectures, to non-Baha'is. Make a list of all the things that you possess. Make a list of all the things that you would like to possess. And now go over them one by one and say, which one of these things could not be taken away from me by circumstances beyond my control? And you will come out with nothing. So we are secure in our possession of nothing. Okay? You're proud of your physical beauty? Well, a disease or an accident can destroy that in 1 minute to the next. You have no control over it, okay? You can get a disfiguring disease tomorrow. You're proud of your sexual powers? A slight hormonal imbalance in your system can destroy your sexual power. You are proud of your mind and your intellect? You can just a slight perturbation of your nervous system is sufficient to render your mind in this world dysfunctional. You are proud of your eloquence or whatever. Anything that you think you possess, material or spiritual, all comes from God. Everything comes from God. Now you see, the point is that this has always been the case. In other words, religion has sometimes been described, or spiritual progress is sometimes being described as learning to depend on God, or becoming dependent on God. In fact, every human being, everything in creation, is totally dependent on God at every minute. We can't increase our dependence on God. We're absolutely dependent on God. The only thing we can change is our degree of awareness of this dependency. So this is my definition of faith. Faith is our awareness of our dependency on God. So you see, the materialist says faith and religion are for weak people. They're for people who can't stand on their own, who need help, so they have to believe in these fairy stories about God and prophets and spirits and help from the other world and all this stuff. This is just magic. This is superstition. The realist knows that he can only depend on himself and so on and so on. As it says in the Old Testament, the foolish has said in his heart, there is no God. Or equivalently, I have no need of God. Well, the point is, you see, that everything that this person thinks he possesses, his mind, his intellect, all of his capacities come from God. God can take them away from him at any time. But he is simply unaware of this fact. He is simply unaware of this fact. He has chosen to be unaware of it, to remain unaware of it. So, you see, religion is truth. Religion is not this relationship with God, this authentic relationship, is based on objective laws and principles. It is not a subjective thing. I mean, it is subjective in the sense that it's a relationship between subjects, but the principles upon which this relationship between, let's say, the relationship is objective. The subjects are subjects. But the relationship is objective. It is based on objective laws and principles. So, to pursue this authentic relationship with God means to destroy certain illusions which we have generated, not just individually, but collectively as a society. And one of these illusions is the illusion of possession, the illusion of control, that we possess and control certain things, whether physical, social, material, or spiritual. We possess nothing. We are possessed by God. We swim in the ocean of God. You know this statement of Abdu'l-Bahá that he asked someone who was asking about spirituality. Abdu'l-Bahá says, how can a basket, a straw basket, be full of water? And the person said, well, a straw basket can't hold water. So if you, no matter how much water you pour in it, it will go out. A straw basket can't be full of water. Abdu'l-Bahá says, suppose you immerse it in the ocean. Then it is always full of water. So you see, we don't perceive ourselves as this straw basket. We perceive ourselves as something which can contain, possess, you see, that can be filled up. And we are proud in our sense of being full and possessing and having control. But in fact, we are like the straw basket which can't possess anything. But we can immerse ourselves in the ocean, you see, and therefore be continually full. But the condition of being continually full is to give up this illusion of control. Which is just another way of saying of having a true picture, a scientific picture of what you really are, of what the human condition is. Now the point is that although you may initially think as you start out on this path that this, because, well, as we said yesterday, the path of spiritual growth is a path of increasing happiness or well-being and increasing autonomy. As we develop spiritually, we become happier, we become more fulfilled, our well-being increases, because God loves us, he wants us to be happy. He's telling, he wants us to be happy so much that he's taken the trouble of sending Baha'u'llah to tell us how to be happy. You want to be happy? Read the Kitab Yaqdas. He tells you what to do. Say your prayers, you know, do these things. Don't get divorces. Don't screw around. Don't take drugs. I mean, he tells you what to do. If you want to be happy, do it. If you don't want to do it, don't do it. Okay? If you want to be happy, that's the way to be happy. All right? Now, and because God wants our participation, also our autonomy increases. Now, what does autonomy mean? It means our capacity to choose what we want to choose. Let me write that down. Autonomy means the capacity, or let's say ability, because it means the actualization. An ability is an actualized capacity. The ability to choose what we want to choose. Now, you may say, well, this is the most redundant, meaningless definition I've ever seen in my life. Certainly, if we have a free will, then we are free to choose what we want to choose. All we have to do is choose it. But that's not true. That's not true. Let me give you a simple example, and I think you will see immediately what I'm talking about. Suppose you have a relationship, well, let's say we could make it husband and wife, or let's say mother-daughter, say, okay? You have a relationship with your mother. This relationship has a history, a long history. Your mother carried you in your womb and so on, developed, nurtured you. And now you're a grown adult, let's say. And suppose that there are tensions and difficulties in your relationship with your mother. Suppose that there's a lot of anger and vindictiveness and manipulation in your relationship between you and your mother. And you suffer from this. And you don't know what to do. You don't know how to overcome this. I mean, you think about it, you pray about it, but every time you come into this relationship again, all of this comes up, and there's tensions, and it's unpleasant. And you don't like that. Now, you have a choice, of course. You could walk away from the relationship. You could say, well, you know, one way to avoid the tensions is just to avoid the relationship. I don't have a relationship, I don't have the tension. That's true. That is a choice you have, but that's not the choice you want. You know, you don't want to walk away from this relationship. That's not what you want to choose. What you would like to choose is to get rid of the tensions. But you don't know how. You don't know how. How do I do it? I don't know how. You know, it comes up. It's stronger than I am. These feelings come up and I can't control them, and my mother's the same way. So you are not autonomous in your relationship with your mother. You have not achieved autonomy because you do not have the ability to choose what you want to choose. You would like to choose to have a harmonious relationship. That's what your desire is. But you don't, you are unable to make that choice because you are not autonomous. So, autonomy is the ability to choose what we want to choose. Now, of course, one can be autonomous and choose wrongly, but the consequences of wrong choice are that you decrease your autonomy. And so if the autonomous person evaluates the consequences of his choices. So an autonomous person, a morally autonomous person, can make wrong choices. In fact, we all will make wrong choices, no matter how developed spiritually we are. But there's no danger in making wrong choices because wrong choices can give us just as much information about ourselves and about our spiritual development as correct choices. In fact, sometimes wrong choices can give us more information because it's much easier to know why we loused up, why we made a mistake, than it is to know why we succeeded, okay? I mean, when we succeed, it may be because somebody prayed for us at that moment, all right, that we don't even know about. We may not ever know why we succeed. But if we fail, we're much more liable to know why it is we failed. All right? So it is part of the whole process is that we will make wrong choices. Now that, again, does not mean that we should deliberately make wrong choices. What I'm saying is that we will make wrong choices even when we deploy all of our knowledge and our love and our desire and our will to make the best possible choice, we will still make mistakes. But these mistakes will simply be stepping stones to more autonomy if we evaluate, find out why we made the mistake, and correct the thing. So this is all part of the process, of a healthy growth process. So you see, the Baha'i morality is a dynamic morality. It is a morality of growth and development. So really, if I expanded the definition of faith, I would say faith is our degree of awareness of our dependency on God, and that makes faith into a process. Faith, increasing our faith, remember Baha'u'llah says we should increase our faith each day over the previous day. Increasing our faith means increasing our awareness of our dependency on God, because everything that touches the human condition is relative anyway. Whenever we're talking about a human thing, we're talking about a process, okay? I mean, everything is process that has to do with us, because we never achieve a static state. So the process of spiritual development then is a process which leads to an increase in our well-being and an increase in our autonomy. And there may be temporary reversals. In other words, we may decrease our autonomy by making wrong choices, but then we can evaluate and remove the cause of the wrong choice and therefore become even more autonomous than we were before. And of course, another consequence of making wrong choices is that we will be temporarily unhappy. All right, we will have loused up and we will feel bad about ourselves, and maybe other people will feel bad about us and will let us know about that, and so on and so on. But again, by evaluating the thing and so on, we can ultimately increase our overall happiness to an even greater degree. So it's not, if you will, we should make this arrow something like this, okay? You know, it's the overall direction is towards an increase, but there are ups and downs and so on. It is a process, okay? In this world, it is a process of ups and downs and so on, of learning how to increase our happiness and autonomy. So this is the process of spiritual development of increasing our happiness and autonomy. So we could take this as an overall spiritual motto. I mean, we can deduce virtually all the Baha'i laws from this thing. That is good which increases our well-being and our autonomy, or that of other people. I mean, we're not the only people involved. So that, let's put it in general, impersonal terms. That which increases well-being and autonomy is good. That which inhibits or decreases well-being and autonomy is bad. Though that presumes that we know what will increase our well-being and autonomy and what will. And this knowledge comes partly from science, as we saw yesterday, and partly from religion. Ultimately, it all comes from God. Ultimately, this knowledge all comes from God, but we get this knowledge partly through the process of observation, trial and error, scientific method, and partly from revelation, or more precisely from our pursuit of authentic relationship, based on our knowledge of the revelation. So recall the statement of Shoghi Effendi, where he said, the grace of the sustaining grace of Baha'u'llah will be totally withdrawn from the Baha'i who does not in the long run arrive. The sustaining grace of Baha'u'llah will be totally withdrawn from the Baha'i who does not in the long run arise. Okay? So there again, we see this fact that an appropriate response is absolutely necessary. Now, as I say, this leads to an increase in our well-being and our autonomy. It leads to an increase in our awareness of our dependency on God, and therefore an increased submission to the will of God. So why is it that more of us do not pursue this process? Well, I think part of the answer lies in the fact that when we begin to discover the will of God in our lives, we don't necessarily like it. And so we cut short this process and we prefer to be a Baha'i whose religion is Baha'i, as Shoghi Effendi says, rather than a Baha'i who lives for the faith. So this is a choice that we have. This is a choice that we have. In other words, we can be a Baha'i whose religion is Baha'i, and so we go through the motions of being a Baha'i, but we don't pursue this process of authentic relationship. I mean, to put it very clearly, suppose you say, okay, I'm going to seek the will of God, and suppose it becomes quite clear that the will of God is for you to pioneer to Antarctica. And, you know, you don't want to pioneer to Antarctica. Well, you know, there it is, okay? You know, God would say, well, you wanted to know what my will is, and that's it, you know? As Shoghi Effendi told us we should, read again and again the life of Abdu'l Baha. I'm sure you know this. Abdu'l Baha used to say to people, the first thing Abdu'l Baha tells you is the best thing, because many times people would say, Abdu'l Baha, what should I do? And he would tell them, and then they would become utterly distraught because they didn't like what he told them. And so then he would say, okay, well, then do such and such a thing. But he would say, the first thing Abdu'l Baha tells you is the best thing. Read the diary of Juliet Thompson, which is not so, in my view, not so interesting from what it reveals about Juliet Thompson, but for what it reveals about Abdu'l Baha and how he dealt with the foibles of human nature. I mean, one of the things is that Juliet Thompson was in love with this Dr. Grant, and she wanted this relationship to work out. And Abdu'l Baha kept telling her, first in very clear terms, and then when she couldn't take that, in more veiled terms, that this was not meant to be, and that this was not a healthy relationship. But always respecting her freedom, at one point he told her, look, either marry the man or cut off your relationship with him completely. In other words, staying in this sort of limbo of, you know, is very unhealthy for you. So he says, either marry the man, resolve the question one way or the other, either marry him and say, okay, that's what you want to do, or cut off your relationship entirely with him. And so ultimately, of course, he led her to have experiences in which she saw and finally accepted that this was not, you know, for her. But the point again is that this is why we have to have this vision of what true moral and spiritual development is. Because it's only this vision that will carry us through this shock, the initial shock of abandoning these illusions that we cherish, these illusions of possession, these illusions of control. You see, why would we be shocked? Why would I be shocked at discovering that the will of God for me is to pioneer to Antarctica if I am utterly convinced that God loves me infinitely and that the will of God for me is the best thing for me, okay? That this will lead to an increase in my well-being and my autonomy, okay? If I'm really convinced of this, why would I resist this in any way? Well, I would resist it only because I'm attached to other things because I'm attached to the comforts of life here or whatever, or I'm attached to my status in the Baha'i community here or whatever, or anything else, you know, and I don't want to go off to Antarctica where I'm going to be teaching the penguins, you know. I'm going, you know, I prefer to be here, a counselor, an NSA member, or whatever, right? Or, you know. So, I mean, I could be attached to my service here, to my status in the community, or anything else. Now, I'm not saying that it's the will of God for everybody to go off pioneering to Antarctica. All I'm saying is, I'm just simply giving an example of the sort of thing that's going to happen. When you really ask for the will of God, and you want it, then He's going to show you, because that's the contract, that's the covenant. That's the covenant. If you really want to know, He will tell you. But then, once you know, then you then have the responsibility of acting on it. Okay? And of course, He's not going to destroy you if you don't act on it. He's not going to say, okay, I told you to go to Antarctica, you didn't go, so now, you know, I'm going to send 1,000 plagues and so on and kill your eldest child and all that. I mean, He's not going to do that. But simply, there will be a decrease in your autonomy and your well-being. You will simply stagnate, if you will, in your spiritual growth. And so, the only one that will suffer will you. He will find somebody else to go to Antarctica if that's the need. You know. So, the faith doesn't need you. God doesn't need you. Baha'u'llah doesn't need you. It's for your benefit that you go pioneering to Antarctica, if that's the will of God. Because everything that is the will of God for us is for our benefit alone. You see? So, you know, we have to give up the illusion that we are, in some sense, necessary to the progress of the faith, or the growth of the faith, or that God needs us. I'll tell you a secret that I have discovered, partly as a result of serving on national assemblies, namely that the whole administrative order from top to bottom is an immense training exercise. God runs the whole faith, okay? The whole faith is run by Baha'u'llah. We don't control anything in the faith. He's just giving us experience in learning how to consult and live together. All of the really important things, He just does it. But He does it in such a way that we have the illusion. He permits us to have the illusion that we have somehow contributed to it, but He's really doing the whole thing, okay? So, you don't want to go through this training exercise. You find it too difficult to learn how to consult, to suppress your own opinions, and so on and so on, in favor of the needs of the faith. Well, you know, don't do it. But it's for your benefit, and for all of our benefit that He's doing. It's not because God needs it. It's not because God needs it. We need it. It's for ourselves that we do this. Now, so I think this is one of the reasons why this process is not pursued. Remember the first day, yesterday, I put what I call the fundamental paradox of Baha'i experience, namely that the faith is such a powerful thing and that so few people on earth, Baha'is or not, recognize this power. And how could this be that such a powerful thing exists and yet the existence of this powerful thing could be so unnoticed and so unexploited? And the answer that we came up with was that access to this power is conditioned, that it is predicated on certain conditions, and the conditions are that we give a certain appropriate response in our dialogue with God. In other words, in a word, that we have to learn how to use the power before God is going to give us access to it. Otherwise, we will misuse it. It will simply destroy ourselves. It will not be for our benefit. It's not because He's afraid to share this power. He's sent Baha'u'llah and given this power in order that it be used. But we have to learn how to use it. Otherwise, we'll use it for our destruction. And the whole history of covenant breaking, which you can read in Tahir Zadeh's book about the covenant, shows you, gives you a history of those who have misused it in various ways. So, are tempted to misuse it. So as I say, I'm suggesting that the reason why more of us have not pursued this process is not because the process is inherently difficult. Again, I'm warring against this notion that spiritual development is some exotic thing reserved for a few saints, a few specially endowed people. This is not the case. It is accessible to every living human being on earth. And I'm suggesting that the only reason why it is not pursued is because we cling to these illusions of possession, of power, of control, and therefore we are reluctant to pursue this process, and we are initially shocked by the response that happens when we do pursue it. When we begin to pursue it and God shows us certain things about ourselves that we were unaware of, then we become frightened. We become frightened. I mean, that's it. We become frightened and then we draw back. And remember what it says in the fire tablet. When the shafts fly, what does he say? What do you do when the shafts fly? You press onward. You don't withdraw. So if the shafts begin to fly, well, that's the proof that you're going forward. And so then you have to press onward more. If you withdraw when the shafts fly, then you may protect yourself from the shafts, but then you will be stagnated at that thing, you know. So that again is the courage to suffer that I talked about yesterday. Which again, I hate to repeat myself, but I know these traps because I've been through all of this in my own life and so on. This does not mean that we seek suffering. It means we have to be willing to suffer for a higher goal, not that we seek suffering. Okay, now I want to put all of this, I want to take the remainder of this session to put all of this in some kind of historical context. So we want to look at the history of the human race. And what is the nature of history? We want to know why it is that in history this process has not been pursued to a greater extent than that. And the first observation is that human history is a history of injustice. We inherit a history of injustice. The most pervasive feature of human history is the pervasiveness of injustice. What is injustice? Injustice is the existence of asymmetrical relationships, relationships of dominance. The most obvious and easily explainable example is slavery, where one segment of a population is systematically, this is a structural thing, okay, slavery, is systematically deprived of its freedom and made to produce more than it consumes, and the overproduction of the slaves is consumed by the masters. This is then a logical definition of slavery, which covers all forms that this can take. So slavery is a social structure in which some segment, some identifiable segment of society is systematically deprived of its freedom, or its freedom is systematically limited, and in which this segment of society is forced to produce more than it consumes. If it only produces what it consumes, then what's the point? It is forced to produce more than it consumes, and the overproduction is consumed by those who have the power to maintain this structural relationship. In other words, to force these people, to deprive them of their freedom, and to force them to do this. Well, this is slavery, which has taken many forms, industrial slavery, chattel slavery, and so on and so on. Now, just to remind ourselves of the pervasiveness of slavery, let's simply observe that slavery has been the basis of every civilization from the dawn of time until the 19th century. When was slavery abolished? In North America?
1863.
1863, okay. When was serfdom abolished in Russia?
1917, no.
No, that's, what?
1860, Alexander
III. That's right. Alexander the Second, wasn't it?
Maybe.
Yeah, that's right, in 1868, okay? The serfdom was abolished in Russia. Now, think of this. At the point that serfdom was abolished, 90% of the total population of Russia was in serfdom. Now, at its highest point, black slavery in the United States involved only 25% of the total population. Now, I'm not saying that this is nothing, okay. All I'm saying is that 25% as opposed to 90% is quite a bit of difference, all right? Furthermore, the conditions of serfdom or slavery in Russia were every bit as inhuman as black slavery in the United States. Every bit as inhuman. The serf was a chattel of his master. He had no rights. He could be killed with impunity. His wife could be raped or taken away with impunity. He had no recourse in law or justice to anything that was done. He was absolutely bound to his master. And this was 90% of the population.